Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 92, featuring Matt Winston. If you don't know who Matt Winston is, you certainly know his father, Stan Winston, who is the legendary special practical makeup effects person out there. He is a legend in the world. He's done such movies as Jurassic Park, The Terminator, Terminator 2, Aliens, Galaxy Quest. I mean, just an incredible roster. Unfortunately, Stan died in 2008. And so Matt has been sort of going around and giving talks about his dad, which is what his dad has been wanting him to do, to spread the word and knowledge about what's going on. And what Matt is also doing is he started an online school called the Stan Winston School of Character Arts, which is really great. And you guys should go check it out. It's really amazing what they're doing. It's stanwinstonschool.com, and go check out those things. It was really incredible to talk to Matt at THU. This is the second podcast I'm doing about THU 2016, which is Trojan Horse Was a Unicorn. And for those of you who didn't hear last week, I want to make sure you guys know about a promotion we're doing. We're helping out THU with a promotion for THU TV. So they recorded all of the talks at Trojan Horse Was a Unicorn, which was great. One of the best conferences, seriously, of the year that I can imagine. And I loved the content. So I can always go back and rewatch those lectures on THU TV. So just Google THU TV and you'll find it very quickly. Or if you want to go to the direct link, it's trojan-unicorn.com/TV. And when you sign up, use the promo code CG Garage, all one word, CG Garage, and you will get a 20% discount on THU TV, which is really great. But it is limited to 100 people, so you should hurry up and sign up soon in case those run out. But I would love to hear what you guys think about it when you do listen to it and you do watch those talks as well. So that's about it. I do have a couple other announcements. We will be at several events in the coming months. So I was going to let you know a few about a few of those. October 19th through the 22nd, we're going to be at RTC Europe, which is in Porto, Portugal. And on October 27th and the 28th, we will be at Animago conference in Munich, Germany. And on October 27th, we'll be also in Stockholm, Sweden at the Roygalan conference. Sorry if I butchered that name. November 10th, we will be in Mexico City, Mexico for Autodesk University in Mexico. And on November 15th through 17th, we'll be in Las Vegas, USA, in Nevada, in case you don't know where Las Vegas is. And it is for Autodesk University in Vegas. So definitely check us out. We have lots of stuff going on. And if you want to sort of know where, you know, to check all these things out, just go to chaosgroup.com/events. And that is where all of our events are listed. And you can just keep track of what's new and what's going on. All right, guys, thanks so much. I appreciate it. And hopefully you guys will be able to see some of the cool stuff we're doing. And you guys enjoyed this podcast as much as I enjoyed hanging out with Matt. It was really great. All right, thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Your talk yesterday was, I believe, like one of the first talks that happened yesterday, besides the workshops that happened in the morning.
Yeah, I guess they're trying to get the worst stuff out of the way to have a beautiful week, so they started out with me.
Well, it was very good. I really liked it, and I think, you know, I've known of your father for forever. He's a legend in the industry, and I started my career at Digital Domain, so obviously that legacy that Scott had with him, and I think even Scott called him his rabbi. Like he called your dad like his the person that gave him all of the, you know, the insightful knowledge that he wanted. Mm-hmm. So I've been looking forward to this ever since I saw that you were going to be talking about it. But tell me a little bit about the legacy of your dad. Like,
wow. Well, of course, there's the characters. I mean, are we talking about telling your listeners the stuff he built? Is that the legacy you'd like to discuss?
We can do that a little bit. And to be honest, I want to hear about what he was like as a father to you, because that's kind of the special thing. You know, you always hear about the amazing things that your dad did.
Of course.
But the personal side, that's the thing that touched me about your talk, is that he had a personality that was, what was it like to have Stan Winston as a dad?
Well, you know, he was so silly. Mm-hmm. He was always, wherever we were, right. He loved to goof off and make everyone uncomfortable. He'd always take it too far. One of his favorite things to do was, he saw someone he knew and loved at a restaurant, he would walk up and he would just put his hands in their food and ruin their meal. And that was him. I mean, he just was a goofy guy who took it too far all the time, and he cracked us up and he embarrassed us.
Yeah.
But it was just, I was the luckiest boy in the world. I mean, honestly, sure. He was a hard, hardworking man, and he spent lots of time at his shop, but when he was home, he was completely present.
Right.
You know, our house was not filled with Terminators and Raptors. It was just a normal house. You would never knew what Dad did for a living from the house, and that was on purpose. You know, he wanted to
separate it
mm-hmm. and make sure that he gave that time to family. You know, he came to every school play, every sporting event.
Yep.
He was always, always, always there. So he was just an awesome pop, you know.
Yeah.
You know, everyone thinks of him as a legendary Stan Winston. Really, at his core, to me, he's just Dad, and to my sister Debbie, you know.
Right. But he did bring a little bit of his goofiness to the house as well.
Oh, would you like me to tell some stories about the things the horrors he visited upon his children?
Yeah, because that story just had me in tears.
Okay, in addition to the funny side of Dad, he also loved to scare us. I mean, that was probably his greatest joy. He loved to make us laugh, but he really loved to scare the crap out of his children. And he didn't wait until we were old enough. He did it when we were very, very young. And one story that I told during my talk, which I'll tell your listeners now. I'll tell two of them.
Well, just tell one, because I want them to go to THU TV and listen to the other one. All
right. So the one I'll tell you is, I think, the ghoul story. So one of his favorite things to do was to make himself up in a simple ghoul makeup, you know, dead, scary face with sunken eyes and this rictus of a grin and just horrifying. And I remember just being in my room, finishing my homework or whatever it would be I would be doing, and this face would slowly come up mm-hmm. in the window. And it was always at night, you know, so all I would see was the face. And I'd scream and I'd run to another room.
Right.
And before too long, that face would appear in the window of that room. And I would run to the furthest corner of the house, and here's the face again. Right. And I would run to Mom. It's Dad. I know it's Dad, but it's freaking me out. Please tell him to stop, Mom. And she would just quietly shake her head and say, You know, I can't do anything.
He's never going to stop.
This is what he does.
Yeah.
This is what he does. And I'd say, okay.
But he must have done these things all the time.
All the time.
All the time. Anytime, not just to you or to everyone.
Yeah. Everyone. Anytime you'd enter a room, he would be behind the door and pop out and scare you. That was just his thing. He loved it. And he found a way to make a fantastic career out of his love of making you pee in your pants.
right. And so another part of the story that I like, I'm just going to jump around a bit if that's okay. But at his workshop, you showed a painting that they had on the wall that he mimicked from the Sistine Chapel, right?
Yes.
And it was of replacing the characters of the Sistine Chapel with characters that was built in the
That's
shop, right?
That's right. And the picture I showed was of a gorilla from Congo reaching out to the Terminator T-800, and it's mimicking the God and Adam
touching
the fingers moment.
But the point that you made in that was that he talked about the fact, and while that was somewhat not serious of a painting, but you mentioned the fact that he said that we, the artists, are patrons of some kind. So can you
yes, say that? Yes. So he always, one of his biggest, I guess, driving passions throughout his career was to elevate the perception of the work that was being done by craftsmen for films. Mm-hmm. And this started from the very beginning. He felt that makeup artistry and helping actors become a character was a real art, mm-hmm. That the craftsman who until then had been relegated to the end of the credits, mm-hmm. on a list of just craftsmen and technicians, really should be celebrated as artists. And in fact, some of the most important artists on the film, they were actually creating the stars of the film. Mm-hmm. And he always felt that the spotlight should be there. And he also furthered that as his studio grew and as he brought in the greatest sculptors, the greatest illustrators, the greatest painters. He would tell people as he toured them through the shop that, back in the Renaissance, the churches were the patrons of the arts.
Right.
That's where the greatest artists were. In the last 100 years, the patrons have been entertainment. Mm-hmm. So the artistry you're seeing is on par with the greatest artists of the Renaissance. Michelangelo and Da Vinci. I mean, if they were alive today, this is where they'd be working.
Yeah.
And he honestly believed that, and he was correct. I mean,
I think it was the first time that when you said that, it made complete sense to me, because if you look back at history, art has always defined different parts of history way almost more than the politics and the economics mm-hmm. that we define our present with. It's always the arts that define things. We talk about the Renaissance. When we talk about the Renaissance, we're talking about the art. We talk about, medieval times, we're talking about medieval art. Mm-hmm. We're talking about all these different things. Yes, there are historic moments in there, but the representation of those periods has always been about art. And I hadn't really thought about it, but if I'm thinking now, a couple hundred years from now, our form, our media, our entertainment, our stories, is going to be defined by the art that we create now, which is the movies.
That's right. And all filmed entertainment and animation. I mean, that is the living record of the last 100 years. Of course, there will be reams of text that future people can read about this day, but really watching the movies is going to be the fun way to learn about the history of our time.
And yeah.
That's exactly. I mean, of course, there, I'm sure, are texts and scrolls of Renaissance history, but what most people are exposed to is not that. They are exposed to the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel and the David standing there at the Academy in Florence.
Right.
That's the thing that people are excited to see, and therefore that's how they learn about and understand that period of time.
Sure.
And the same as you're saying, of course.
And I think it's wonderful that your dad took that seriously as his own form. Besides having fun and loving what he does, he knew that he had some responsibility towards the legacy of our time, in a sense, right?
Absolutely. He always focused on, of course, there was the fantastic element in everything he did.
Yep.
The impossible character made a reality, but reality was always the key for him. He always said, it's one thing to create a fantastic character. It's another thing to create a fantastic character that people believe is real. Mm-hmm. And so his emphasis was always on, with his crew, and even before he had a huge crew, mm-hmm. was study nature, bring it from nature, study your world, mm-hmm. and draw from reality and invest your characters with that. So I think Yes, his creations. I mean, the Terminator robot, they put at the time all, you know, all sorts of ideas that were based on the mechanics of today. So, mm-hmm. yeah, so insisting on approaching his characters from a realistic standpoint helped he and his team capture today and, sure. And even the future, and have defined the future a little bit with yeah. some of their creations.
Well, I think another thing that, that struck me also is there are parallels between visual effects and practical effects, and I'm going to get into a debate a little bit about that because I think it's definitely worth talking about. But I was really also thinking about the fact that you were talking about him examining the Chewbacca mask, right?
Yes.
So tell the just to give a little backstory about how that Chewbacca mask ended up in your house.
Yes. So, you know, when Dad he had just moved out on his own and things were growing. He was an established makeup artist now, but it was time to push into characters that were beyond makeups, that were, you know, had external manipulation and could create more extreme characters. One of the first times he got to do it was Star Wars Holiday Special, which right. was so bad. But he was thrilled to be a part of it and mm-hmm. had the opportunity to learn from the great Stuart Freeborn, who had mm-hmm. done the Chewbacca character and Yoda for all the Star Wars. He was right. also 2001.
Yep.
He was a great, great groundbreaking makeup effects guy. Mm-hmm. So Stuart kindly sent the Chewbacca mask to my dad
right.
in Los Angeles to look at and to investigate. I don't know why he agreed to do it,
right.
but Dad knew, okay, all innovation comes from a foundation of shared knowledge, and I'm going to learn every bit I can about this mask.
Right.
And so he figured out the cable actuators. He figured, okay, good, this is how they segmented it, and he applied that to this new family of Chewbaccas.
Right.
And he did that throughout his career. I mean, he was shameless about it, and he right. was very vocal about it. He said, you know, good borrows, genius steals.
Right.
And I am going to learn everything I can from my predecessors and my peers.
Right.
Not so I can recreate what they did, but so I can improve upon it.
Right.
And then they can look at what I did and improve upon that. And then, right. you know, everyone rises. So, yeah, he was always big on investigating what had come before.
And I think that's an incredibly good point, because I think the idea of just ripping off knowledge, because why not just advanced, right? You're not going to why reinvent something that's already
exactly.
been done. But the other thing that I think is fascinating, just to is I was thinking, oh, he had to deal with so much technology and so much art at the same time, mm-hmm. right? So he had to. So he was trying to reverse engineer this mask by studying it and improve upon it, and then also recreate the believability of Chewbacca at the same time. So he had to engineer this mask. And so I was thinking about it, it's like, this is basically a lot of the problems we deal with in CG. It's like the struggle between, you know, creating an incredible fluid simulator mm-hmm. that deals with all the mechanics and the physics and all of that stuff, and then making a beautiful ocean at the same time, right? So you have to balance that. And he basically dealt with the same struggles every day.
Like, oh, always. The studio was a place of art and science.
Right.
Completely. I mean, half the crew were, you know, sculptors and fine artists. The other half were aerospace engineers,
right,
and mechanical wizards,
right.
So, yeah, I mean, to have the artistic idea mm-hmm. is one thing; to bring it to life and give it movement is another,
right.
And that requires art and science. And
yeah.
that the history of the shop was about breaking boundaries in both.
Right.
How do you create the most beautiful artistic creations?
Uh huh.
And do it in a way that is also breaking technological ground. And they did that all the time. I think the story of the technological advances is just as exciting
exactly.
as the artistic achievements they yeah. had at the studio.
Absolutely. Because I think that's something, you know, obviously, I think, you know, obviously THU is a lot about art inspiration, right? But one thing that struck me is the how important the technology is that goes in behind things, and mm-hmm. how it's built to support the art,
and that's number one.
Right,
it must support the art.
Right,
Dad was very tough on his team because mm-hmm. the design process always was about the art. How do we create the coolest, most real, believable, artistic image we can. Mm-hmm. And then the mechanics were forced to figure out a way to bring that art to life and right. not change the art to serve the mechanical side of things.
Right.
And it was always art first, and that made it even tougher on the technique, because it's like, okay, we have Teddy from AI. We have this tiny little teddy bear.
Right.
And, you know, it would be really great if we could make him oversized so we could fit more mechanisms and do all the things you want him to do. And Ted goes, nope.
No.
He has to be that size. He's in all these scenes with Haley Joel Osment.
Right.
We're not going to shoot it against a green screen and composite them together. He's going to be on his lap. This is the size. This is what you have to work with.
Right.
Figure it out.
Yeah. I've always said that creativity is always more interesting if you start with restrictions.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so I think that the technical side of things is just as creative because of those restrictions that you lay upon things. And I think that's an important thing to work with in a lot of ways, you know?
Oh, restrictions set us free. Right. You have your guidelines and you go, okay, within that framework, within that pathway, mm-hmm. within that sort of vision that's been set.
Right.
Okay, how do we find efficient ways and creative ways to make that happen?
Right.
You know, what necessity is the mother of invention.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's some really beautiful, beautiful things that are done. Were there a lot of people that worked there that actually felt, was there sort of a separation, do you feel, between the technical people and the artist people, or was there a lot more like some like blending? How did they blend together? Because, you know, in visual effects, for example, there's still a little bit of a separation between the guy in building the tool and the person applying that tool to something else.
Yes. Well, there's always going to be a bit of a push and pull between any departments that work together on any process. Mm-hmm. I mean, every department feels their department is really the most important department, and also relies upon the previous or department following mm-hmm. to make sure that, you know, their work is preserved and, you know, fits the bigger vision.
Right.
So there's always some push and pull. And also it's a right brain, left brain thing, you know, the artsies versus the number guys. And there is a bit of a linguistic chasm there, but mm-hmm. but I would say that my dad's studio, at Stan Winston's studio, and mm-hmm. I know that what really mattered always mm-hmm. was, what is this character we're creating? It's not about how we get there. It's about that. Keep that in mind. Mm-hmm. What we're doing here is not sculpting for the sake of sculpting. We're sculpting to capture that character. What we're building is to bring that character to life. So everyone shared the same goal,
right?
Which was always about that end result. How do you get something remarkable on screen? Mm-hmm. And so even though there might've been push and pull, I think everyone realized that in the end, it wasn't about their department, that no one department can get this done. We all have to work together.
Right.
And so there's always a way to find compromise. And really the team spirit was remarkable.
Right.
Because, you know, they had a leader in Stan who mm-hmm. said, that's how it's going to be.
Right.
We're all in this together.
Right. 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 And how big did it get? I mean,
it would get up to, I mean, there, I would say about 1,000 artists went through the doors over the course of Dad's 40-year history.
Right.
But it would fluctuate between 50 to maybe 250, depending on the size of the job. So not massive, not like a CGI department on a feature by any stretch. But to be around that many artists during the biggest shows is incredible. You'd walk through the shop and every corner there's someone doing something amazing. Sure. Someone making eyeballs over there, casting teeth over there, creating mechanical walking legs over there.
Right.
You know, a robotic head over there, digitally designing a crazy creature. You know, I mean, it was just, wow.
And what do you think was his favorite thing that he did? Like, what was the show, do you think, that he really, I mean, that's probably hard to answer. He probably loved all of them, but what do you think the one where he just was so excited to go to work for?
I would say Jurassic Park.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah. Jurassic Park was for everyone a dream come true. Mm-hmm. I mean, to bring dinosaurs to life. I mean, every member of the crew felt the same way. We were all like little kids, and I was lucky enough to work on that film for 3 months as a puppeteer.
And, oh, really?
And be there and
wow.
feel that energy. And I think the scope of it, the groundbreaking nature of it, I mean, it was the largest, and to this day remains the largest animatronic ever built for a film, that T-Rex.
Right.
To see it come to life. I mean, he was a little kid every day. And I think he realized as many achievements as he had up until that point, you know, he had worked on The Thing with Rob Bottin and done Terminator and Predator. Mm-hmm. The sheer scale of it, the audacity of it.
Right.
And the fact that they did deliver something so remarkable. I know Dad was just a little kid.
Right.
Of course, you know, he didn't let people see him sweat, but he was also on the inside going, I have promised the impossible.
Yeah, I'm bringing a dinosaur back
I have to get it done.
Yeah. That must have weighed a ton, or more than several tons.
Several tons.
Yeah, it must have been amazing. And just the mechanics of it to make it move the way it did was incredible.
Yes, yeah. And that was a whole... It was the Raptors took a 14-person crew to operate the Hero Raptor,
right?
The most complicated of the there were many raptors built. There were partial raptors, insert legs, insert hands, insert heads. But there was one Hero Raptor puppet that was full of cables. It had a giant bundle of cables coming out of its butt, leading to us, an orchestra of puppeteers. It took 14 of us to operate it. The T-Rex took 6 operators because. With that, Dad had said, you know, to get a cohesive performance, having everyone just moving sliders and not being able to puppeteer in what is the word I'm looking for? In a way that just made intuitive, that's it, intuitive way is going to hurt our performance. So one night he dreamed up a miniature T-Rex. Mm-hmm. That was the same mechanical structure, but in miniature, that 3 puppeteers could get their hands on and just move it around. It was just a T-Rex they were moving around.
Right.
And that's how the T-Rex was puppeteered.
So it was basically small T-Rex.
A small T-Rex.
Remote controls a big T-Rex.
Exactly.
Wow.
So someone would be holding the head of the small one, and wherever they move that head, the big one's going to do the same thing.
Wow.
So what he and his team created was essentially a interactive puppet that was easy to manipulate, that could do whatever Steven wanted.
Right.
And it happened to be 40 feet long and and move at incredible velocity and be very dangerous.
Yeah, I bet it was dangerous.
It was incredibly dangerous. And that's kind of what made it exciting to be on set with it.
Yeah.
Because it could actually kill you.
It brings back that fear moment again.
Yes.
Your dad liked so much.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yes, Jurassic Park for sure.
So, obviously, as you said, it was probably the one he enjoyed a great deal, but it was also something that he worried him, right?
Yes.
But was there other shows that were sort of a concern to him, like a challenge that was hard for him in a lot of ways?
All shows, all of them have their challenges, and he wouldn't have it any other way.
I mean,
what excited Dad was always to do something different, to top what he and his team had achieved before, to do something no one had ever seen.
Right.
So every single job, even if what came to him in the script wasn't that outrageously complicated, he would find a way to push the boundaries and encourage the filmmaker to push it further and raise the level of his own effort he had to put out.
Right.
So every job was like that for him. But, you know, there were certain jobs where certainly, you know, once that production train goes and you're shooting, there's no time for mess ups. You know, T2 stands out.
Yeah.
Terminator 2 was an enormous show.
Right.
They had so much to pull off. And Jim Cameron happens to be the most demanding filmmaker in the history of the world.
Sure.
You know, and rightfully so, the product shows.
Right.
But, you know, there were sleepless nights. I mean, there were nights where he'd be up in the middle of the night dealing with his crew or going into the shop to fix whatever it was. But what Dad was great at is never letting production see him sweat. He always had a smile for them.
Right.
Whenever anything was going wrong, the job of the crew was to keep it quiet, not let production know,
right.
Go to Stan, let Stan know,
Right.
And he would come up with a smile and deliver whatever news it was and immediately deliver a solution.
Right.
You know, we're going to need to push this to the second half of the day. We just have a few things to do.
Right.
But he was a master at making people at ease, even if things were going to shit.
Right. Well, that's good. And that's a skill. And especially because, you know, I've worked in visual effects, so we don't spend much time on set. When things go wrong, we just yell and curse and spend days figuring out how to solve it. You don't have that kind of time on set.
No.
Minutes cost thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
And so that coming up with solutions is got to be tough on that crew.
That's the nature of the beast, though.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone knows you're going into war. You plan for the worst.
Sure.
And hopefully you won't need to do that.
But, right.
But you always plan for it.
Yeah.
Your job is to deliver.
Yeah. So we're going to, I want to talk a little bit, you know, since I brought up the whole, you know, CG versus practical, this is a subject that I think has come up a lot. And right now, as you're, I'm sure you're aware, there's a huge thing, especially in the popular press, sort of villainizing CG in a lot of ways, which honestly I find very disappointing. And it's not to say, necessarily say that practical is not good and CG is bad, because I think that's the wrong thing to ask or to say. But why do you think that CG has become so villainized these days?
Well, I think for the mainstream, I think that they do have a point, which is that CG is incredible. It's here to stay. It has made films that were never possible to make a reality. You can do it now. Mm-hmm. I think what the mainstream audience has gotten a little tired of is that when it's overused, when the laws of nature and physics and all of that are thrown out in the interest of spectacle and making an even more outrageous car chase or making Spider-Man swing even more, you know, sometimes it's just too much and people are like, I don't believe it's there. I want to, when I go to a movie, I want to believe the characters are real.
Sure.
I want to believe they're actually in danger. I don't need everything to be spectacular. So when CGI is used in that way, where it sort of turns real life into a comic book, mm-hmm. I think people get a little tired of that. And I don't think that's necessarily CGI's fault. I think it's the storytelling's fault.
Yeah.
I think, you know, Deadpool.
Yeah.
It's filled with great CGI, but it also has a great story. And so I don't think people are sitting there complaining about the CGI.
Right.
It's when the story's no good and that's all, and the effects are all you have to, you know, focus on.
Right.
Then, Now, I think what mainstream audiences have to realize is that CGI, when used well with the real world, is absolutely phenomenal. And that's happening all the time. Films are doing it that way all the time. Mad Max got so much press for the practical approach, you know, actually going to locations, building those vehicles, real stunts, this and that. But it's filled with CGI.
2,000 shots.
Yeah, filled, you know. And it works.
Right.
Because it's grounded in the physical reality that mm-hmm. was established in camera.
Yep.
And it supports that. And they support each other. So the very concept of CGI versus practical is wrong. It's CGI and practical. It's all good.
And
they shouldn't be against each other. They should only enhance one another.
Right. And don't you think that, you know, the problem, and it's the same problem with practical in a sense. It's really good when people don't even know it's there, right?
Absolutely.
And so the problem is, if we do really good CGI, you don't even realize it's CGI. If you do really good practical effects, you don't even realize that was an effect.
Then that is the goal.
Right.
And Dad always said that. He goes, if you leave a film I worked on saying great effects, I have failed.
Right.
I have failed. My goal, any filmmaker's goal, is to help you suspend that disbelief and believe what you're seeing is real.
Right.
And I think that people left Mad Max not going, great effects, because mm-hmm. it wasn't effects. It was awesome stuff really happening.
Right.
But it was full of effects, mm-hmm. you know? And I think when they go to a movie where the story doesn't really capture them and there's no real sense of reality,
right,
then they're going to say, oh, great effects.
Right. I mean, on a personal note, I had a real problem with Jurassic World, okay? Because I thought, and a lot of people are saying Jurassic Park was better because it was practical, and Jurassic, and they're saying that today. I hear press after press after press about it. Jurassic Park was better because it was practical, and Jurassic World is crap because it's CGI. Now, first of all, Jurassic Park was practical and CG, and the fact that you can't tell which shots were practical and which ones are CG is a testament to both of those, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, and in Jurassic World, it was incredible, incredible, beautiful effects, and I paid attention to them because the story kept me completely blank. I had no interest in the characters. I didn't, you know, I was joking around. It's like, if those two boys died in the first 10 minutes, it would have been the same movie to me. You know, I had no interest in that story. And that's, again, that's a personal thing. But the dinosaurs were beautiful and they were well done and they were well executed and they felt physical in the way they were animated, etc. And that's not the reason that movie failed. It's not because it's CGI, but maybe it's because they spent too much time paying attention to the spectacle of it. I guess that's what it is, right? It's the spectacle.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you have to have an emotional investment. If
right.
it's all spectacle, forget it.
Right.
No one wants that. People want to go see stories about human beings and empathize with what they're going through and have
right.
some sort of emotional resonance.
Right.
And leave the theater going, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
That touched me. Yeah. Even a spectacle has to do that for you. And I thought Jurassic Park really captured a lot of heart, those kids and their relationship with Sam Neill, I thought
yeah.
was really moving and beautiful.
Now, and very believable.
And believable.
And you know, of course, Stephen Olson sort of focused on creating a cast of characters that were mm-hmm. well introduced in the first act, right?
Oh, yes.
So that, you know, all of them, you know, Jeff Goldblum was like
oh, I mean,
the
come
weird
on. Ian Malcolm is yeah. one of the greatest characters
yeah.
ever.
Yes. So every one of those was introduced, and within just a few minutes of meeting that person, you wanted to know more about them and be introduced
yes.
to them.
Well, this is what happens when Steven Spielberg directs movies.
Right.
He understands that it's all about heart. It's all about that. And look, my feeling about Jurassic World is I really, really enjoyed it.
Sure.
As I thought it was a terrific nod to the fans. There were so many moments
yep.
from the previous films that were, you know, great Easter eggs.
Yeah.
But I do agree with you, you know, story-wise, in terms of the characters. Look, I love Chris Pratt. He's so charismatic. But it did lack the... I think a bit of the heart of the first one. And I think maybe that's one of the reasons you felt disassociated. Now,
right.
as far as the effects go, I did think it was remarkable CGI work. But I must tell you that what it lacked was what Jurassic Park had, which was both elements, the physical,
mm-hmm.
where you're not watching the scene going, wow, that really looks like it's there. Instead, you're going, that's there.
Right.
You know, that's really there. That I don't feel that happened.
But
other than the Apatosaurus scene, and I feel like having the real dinosaurs to match to in the first film,
mm-hmm.
and 3/4 of the shots in the first film are real dinosaurs,
mm-hmm.
Forced the digital team
sure.
to stay honest because... they couldn't go beyond what was captured in camera on set under physical, you know, under the laws of physics.
Right.
This is what we're matching to, real life. And I don't think an all digital approach gives you that constraint.
But do you think that also, you know, your dad labored over that T-Rex, right? So it became his love. And that character of the T-Rex was a real character because it had all of that love and personality that was also built into the story. So that investment of that T-Rex, the reason that T-Rex feels real is because there's, through the puppeteering, be it digital, what Spaz was doing or what your dad was doing, was emotionally there. And I, you know... You can't just normally have it, the same. If I'm going to go back to, you know, Jurassic World, it's like they were just a bunch of dinosaurs running around in a lot of ways, right? And doing a bunch of things, like especially the pterodactyls, it was, they didn't have as much soul in a sense, in the same way that you're talking about. But that T-Rex had a practically, you know, was a major character in that. You know, he should have been in the, you know, in the billing at the beginning, T-Rex, you know. So don't you think that that's also part of it as well, is the way that you bond with that fake character?
Yeah, and I think that's true of, even if it's an all CGI approach, if great animators become the character.
Right.
And I do agree that in Jurassic World, there was, you know, I thought the Indominus was pretty cool.
He was.
But yeah, I mean, the raptors in the first one, they were phenomenal in the first one because they were characters.
Exactly.
They were these clever, you know, they were,
right.
They worked together. They
right.
were chess players.
Right.
They were so smart.
Right.
And that's how the film played them. I mean, they were opening doors. They were, you know.
Yeah.
And the T-Rex, of course, I mean, as you said, was this dominant character, this presence.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that they kind of got some of that with the Indominus. But yes, I think great, great monsters are never mindless. They always have intention, and they always are foils for the hero.
Mm-hmm.
And the more well sketched out they are, the better. And I think in an all CGI approach, a Pixar film, I mean, they're the masters of creating characters you,
right.
you care about. So
exactly.
I don't think the technique is really relevant as much as, you know, always remember that your effects or your characters are meant to,
right,
you know, be real.
Again, it's not about it's not about how real it looks. It's how real it feels, I guess, is what I'm
yes.
trying to say, you know.
Yes.
And because I think that's exactly what happened. Like the dinosaurs look very real in Jurassic World, but they didn't feel as real, I guess, maybe because, again, it was the same thing. There was a little bit of a lack of character. And I don't want to bash Jurassic World too much. I've done that a little bit because a lot of people love it, and it's done great.
I saw it twice.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. And they named the steakhouse Winston's. As an
yeah.
honor to Dad, and I thought that was pretty cool.
That is, and look, my son, who's 7, right? He loves Jurassic World, and I said, "All right, well, all right, you're gonna have to watch this other very important movie called Jurassic Park." And he said, "Man, I didn't like it so much." I said, "Why?" And he says, "You know, they're trying to kill the dinosaurs." He actually loved the fact that people were being killed and not the dinosaurs, because he's a huge animal person. So to him, it was about, he was cheering for the dinosaurs the whole time.
Oh, okay. That's cool.
So he, anyway, it was really, really, really funny to hear his perspective on it. But, and I think also, you know, he just loves the action of it too. There was
oh,
a
yeah.
lot more action.
Oh, the scale, of course,
yeah.
is massive. It's yeah. a world, not just a park.
Exactly.
It's a world.
Well, okay. Well, that's really great. And obviously, your dad has left a huge legacy behind him, as you know. And that's what was one of the questions. Like, what is it like to live with that legacy, or to have the burden of that legacy, or to reap the fruits of it? How does that affect you?
Well, I would say the pros are that I got to grow up with, you know, Santa Claus, and I guess mixed with Dr. Frankenstein, maybe more Dr. Frankenstein than Santa Claus.
Right.
I mean, the family business was this magical workshop of wonder.
Right.
And my whole childhood and up until this day is spent interacting with and being inspired by artists of every medium
mm-hmm.
and technological wizards. So mainly being the son of Stan has exposed me to so many inspiring things.
Right.
On the flip side, you know, he achieved great, great things in his life and built a brand that had a sterling reputation in the industry. And so in my own life, you know, I've always strived, even if I'm not going to go be a makeup effects artist. Mm. Acting was what I did for many years. And
wow.
then I became a screenwriter.
Which explains why you did such a great presentation yesterday.
Oh.
Because you You gave a great persona. So yes, acting is great.
Yeah, acting and writing, and now for the last 8 years, Stan Winston School has been my passion. But right. In anything my sister Debbie and I did, my mom and dad always expected that we do our best and that we strive to be great.
Right.
And otherwise, why waste time?
Right.
So there was always the pressure to do well. And we didn't see it as a burden. It was just like, okay. And it wasn't mysterious how you get there. It was just hard work.
Yeah.
That was it. Just work hard. Do what you love and do your best. So always had that pressure. And with the founding of Stan Winston School, have felt enormous pressure to make sure that we uphold the quality of the brand and what he stood for and what his team stood for. So, you know, yeah, there's pressure there, but that's great because it gives me a reason to do my best.
So let's go back to Stan Winston, because I really want to talk about Stan Winston School and understand where people knew it, because basically now you're making sure that he's paying forward in that sense, right?
Yes.
So just like you were saying, like he steals from people, now you're allowing people to steal from him in a lot of ways, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Right. So what was the inspiration that you told a really great story about why you decide to make this school, and tell a little bit about that.
Yes, absolutely. So as Dad loved to steal great ideas, he loved to give ideas away. Mm-hmm. Just like you said, there was a Dick Smith, for those of you who know your makeup effects history, Dick Smith was one of the great innovators, the godfather of makeup effects. He did The Exorcist and the makeups for Amadeus and so many other incredible works. And he was the sort of the first makeup effects artist to really share his techniques. And Dad and he worked together a few times, and they would trade their secrets. And so that became an ethos that Dad also adopted, that of sharing, and the belief that in sharing our techniques, we all benefit because new techniques can be developed.
Right.
And it raises the starting point for all of us. As you said earlier, you don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Right.
Okay, good. We all got this base of shared knowledge. Great. Let's take it somewhere new.
Right.
So he was always into sharing. And in fact, his greatest gesture in his lifetime of sharing was his book, The Winston Effect,
okay.
The Art and History of Stan Winston Studio, in which he revealed the entire history of the studio in photos and descriptions of how things were achieved. Mm-hmm. But what he really wanted to do in the last years of his life was, you know, hoping he would have a chance to step away from the day-to-day business and go to universities and colleges and schools and share the story.
Right.
And share the techniques and share the magic tricks so that a new generation could take it further.
Sure.
When he died and when his team were no longer practicing their arts.
Right.
But he was taken ill, and he never got a chance to do this.
Right.
So when he passed away, we didn't think of doing anything business-wise for quite some time, and we were just devastated. He was he was our main man. He was my best friend. He was my best man at my wedding.
Wow.
And was such a huge, just driving personality of our family.
Right.
So after about a year and a half, we said, okay, now it's time. Now it's time. And we thought about how to honor him and keep his name alive. Mm-hmm. And education was the thing to do because that was his unfinished business. He didn't get to do it.
Right.
So we're like, how do we do that without him here?
Right.
I guess we could dig him up and we could reanimate him and use some animatronics. And that might be weird. Yeah. So we decided not to do that.
Good.
And we thought, okay, education's the way to go. Let's do this for him. Although he's not here, all of his peers are here and his colleagues and those wonderful people who work for him. We can gather everyone together and share how they did it.
Right.
And so that was the beginning of it. And the internet was the way to do it because we wanted to reach everyone.
Right.
So we're an online school. We've brought together all the wizards who worked with Dad, and now you can learn from them from the comfort of your own home.
So what kind of classes and stuff are taught there? Because I think there's a ton of places you can learn VFX and CG, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think I've ever heard of many places where you can learn how to build your own robot, right?
We're the only one.
Okay.
No, there are a lot of educational outlets. There's the whole make movement. There are people teaching everything under the sun. But I think we are unique in that we do teach more advanced techniques in executing practical characters and creatures and makeup effects. All of our instructors are the leading professionals in the character creation industry. And that being said, we are not a school of practical effects by any stretch. We are a school of character arts.
Okay.
And that means any technique used to create a character, whether it's 2D cell animation or stop motion animation or marionetting or, you know, anything.
Right.
You know, makeup effects, CG will cover it.
Okay.
It's all about creating characters. And
great.
Because Dad, he embraced everything. You know, he co-founded Digital Domain with Scott Ross and Jim Cameron. He loved the digital tools. He saw every tool as great and viable, and sometimes you can use them together, and sometimes one works better than the other, depending on what you need. But it's all about creating a character in the end. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're all about.
Right.
So, you know, it's fantastic. And I think what we've tapped into and why we have grown so quickly in the last 6 years is that really at our core, we're just a school of art and science with an awesome hook, which is monsters.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
The fact that we have as our mascots the T-Rex from Jurassic Park and Predator and Terminator makes it a very appealing kind of art school to look into. You know, you're not going to be painting apples and landscapes in your classes. You're going to be painting, you know, apocalyptic futurescapes with killer robots.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. I think that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. I find it fascinating. I actually didn't know about the school until you talked about it yesterday. So I was really just very excited to hear about it. I want to learn more. So how does the school work? Do you just sign up? I mean, what's
the deal? So it's all online, and how we do all of our classes is we find out what our students want to learn. Everything we teach is based on what our students need. And we find the best pro in Hollywood to teach it.
Right.
And we work for some time on a lesson plan, and then we host a live online course.
Okay.
Where students from around the world are right from their computer, are there in studio with us. Mm-hmm. We have a multi-camera setup, so you're seeing ultra close-ups, and it's all right now.
Right.
And you're able to interact with the artist. And some students can sign up and sort of audit the course, which is where they're watching and they're asking questions, but they don't necessarily have to follow along or do the work. And then other students can be workshop students. So they will be working along. They do get their homework assignments, and they have to basically show mastery of all the techniques that are being shared throughout the course. And these courses go on from anywhere from between 2 to 6 weeks.
Okay.
And the work the students are turning out is outrageous.
Right.
You know, they didn't have to buy an airplane ticket and fly out to Los Angeles and get a hotel room and all this. They're doing it from their own home. They can spend that money on materials, and they get a chance to learn from the best. And and their work is critiqued, and real relationships are formed.
Exactly.
And it's just phenomenal. The internet is a great way to learn now.
Absolutely. But I think what's important, what you're distinguishing here, which I think people need to know, is this is not just a bunch of YouTubes of how to make monsters.
These are not 3-minute how-tos. These are 16-hour adventures where you are not just getting the A, B, C. It's much deeper than that.
Right.
It's why this is step A.
Right.
What happened on Terminator 3 that made me change the way I do things.
Right.
Real world stuff.
Right.
These are not professional teachers. These are working professionals who are taking the time to teach. And none of them can take the time to teach full time. So this is a great way to give them an opportunity to reach people without having to leave Los Angeles.
Right. And people can just go to your site, right?
Yes, just stanwinstonschool.com.
Okay.
We have live web courses, which is what I just described.
Yeah.
And then everything we shoot live eventually becomes part of our on-demand web course list. And so is there then for those who weren't able to join live, they still get to sit in and experience what that class was and learn. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. I think people, I'm sure, would be fascinated to do that. And I actually think, honestly, it sounds like people who do visual effects could probably enjoy that as well and to remember some of those old school things. There was you're talking about character. One of the projects I'm deeply involved with is Digital Humans, and just as understanding the challenges of digital humans, right? And so I have this little group. We're open sourcing a digital human. We're calling it the Wiki Human Project, and we're giving it away just like your dad doing. So it makes me feel good that your dad wants to give away secrets. It's like, okay, so I'm not crazy by doing this. And I think it's an important part of the evolution. If digital humans are going to evolve, we have to share that knowledge, right? But one of the great, great modelers that I've ever worked with on digital humans, in visual effects, is a guy named Dan Platt. And Dan, I think the reason he's so good is he was a practical effects sculptor. Mm-hmm. So he used to sculpt people, and he knew, by doing that, he knew more about anatomy than I think most doctors do, you know? So he knew how a face is supposed to move, or why things are there, or why the placement of every pore is important, and how all of those details reflect. And I think that foundation that he had, physically building it with his hands, and knowing, because, you know, when you're putting a pore in by hand, you know how small that is. Mm-hmm. On the computer, you zoom in, you zoom out, you've lost your scale a little bit, but he kept that perspective. And so building something at the same scale, because it's practical the whole time, helps you understand balance and stuff.
Absolutely. I've heard over and over again that traditional sculptors, clay sculptors, or anyone who's sculpting in a physical medium, have a much easier transition into digital modeling than the other direction. Mm-hmm. That those who've only spent their time using digital sculpting tools have a much tougher time getting into the real world, which makes perfect sense, because when you think about it, the goal of both is the same, which is to create something real, right? But the digital modeler who's never sculpted something real doesn't have that frame of reference of manipulating something in real space, in the real world.
Right.
So, yes, you have to have a knowledge of reality and working in physical media to be the best digital artist you can be.
Right.
That was did you see Steve Williams and Mark DePay's talk?
Yes.
At the end of that talk, I mean, these, for those of you who don't know, your listeners, these were two of the rebels at ILM who helped create the digital revolution in film with The Abyss, the Terminator 2, and Jurassic Park.
Right.
But even though they are known for their digital work, at the very end of it, Steve goes, someone said, best advice. He goes, here's my best advice. Go build stuff in steel and wood and physical. And that is going to help your digital
artistry. Yeah. And I think that's what I'm trying to say, is that's a lot of my listeners are computer guys, right? They work on visual effects, they do CG. Part of what I don't know if you, but the software that I work with, the software company I work with, is Chaos Group, and we make a product called V-Ray, which is a rendering engine. And I always tell them, it's like, you want to do some great renderings, then you want to then get a camera and take some pictures, because that's a rendering that you should be looking at, or whatever. That's the camera, you know. Just do it for real. You know, if you want to be a really great sculptor in ZBrush, then get out some clay and start sculpting and see where your stuff is. And I think that, and I think the same is true for an animator in a lot of ways, right?
So if absolutely, get into an acting class,
right?
Learn to become a character,
right? Or puppeteer it,
puppeteer
right?
it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think puppeteering is a beautiful, beautiful thing that, that people have forgotten a little bit about. They don't, you know, it doesn't sound, it sounds like you're playing with toys.
Right.
But it's not. It's
and,
really,
but it also is.
It is. But it is.
And that's and, the cool part about
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Is you actually are just playing with toys and getting paid to do it.
Yeah. It's true. Well, it's been fantastic. This is exactly the what I wanted to make sure people heard about your story and be able to share it. And I want to make sure that people have a chance to go check out Stan Winston School, because I think it is an important thing. And I think that, first of all, it's important that your dad's legacy continues in that way. But I also think that it's an important lesson that people still need to learn as a foundation to what we did. It's not just about visual effects, not just about computers, and not just about software, but it's about bringing things to life and characters to life that couldn't normally exist without these amazing tools.
So, that's right. It is all about bringing characters to life and not limiting yourself.
Right.
You have 150 years of filmmaking history to draw from.
Right.
Why not use it all? Isn't that more fun?
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, thanks so much. I appreciate it, Matt.
Thank you, Christopher.